dinosaurs for Big Ten Talk. It's Off Tackle Empire.
Welcome to Off Tackle Empire, a Big Ten Christmas crossover where we are going to save Christmas from meaningless football, except it's going to be over before it begins because, man, does any football feel meaningful anymore?
We got a lot of problems with this conference, and now you're going to hear about it.
Yep, we are recording on Festivus. I'm Steve Braun, recording from the home of the Iowa Hawkeyes. Yep, good old Naperville, Illinois. True story, Naperville North's fight song is, in fact, Fight for Iowa. Except, I mean, they say Naperville, but
How do you squeeze Naperville? Well, I guess Iowa is actually three syllables, so it's not.
Exactly.
Okay.
We're going to, the word is fight for Naperville. Let every loyal Husky sing.
Okay.
Et cetera.
Yeah. So that actually does line up better than I thought it would. Somehow for a second there, I was like, Naperville is four syllables in my head, but I managed to like
Naperville-y
tongue before I said that, but now everybody knows that I was thinking it. So,
well, anyway, bunch of really stupid things happened. So let's get up with what happened in what was supposed to be the crossover. You know, I just loved the idea of the 1-1, 2-2, 3-3, et cetera, but we couldn't have that anymore because
how very like 2020 to be like, hey, here's this really cool idea that we could execute easily. Oh, but no, actually, because of reasons, we're not going to do that. And instead, we're going to do this other crappy thing.
Well, the best thing is that we still got left with the vestigial Illinois Penn State game and shit like that. Like why couldn't we just have nothing instead? I would have taken that.
That's the part that you got to keep, was you're having to play a phenomenally talented opponent that underachieved for the first month of the season and then, you know, got their shit together just in time to kick your team's ass. Like, that's
so anyway. Nebraska 28, Rutger 21, and
Nebraska tried really hard to give this game away. They did it. This is a game. So Nebraska had over 600 yards of offense, but this was still a one score game because they turned it over four times and they gave off a kick return touchdown. Like, they still, you can see a lot of the time, especially against teams in their own talent bracket, kind of, that they're getting better as a roster, but they still make so many big mistakes, and that's on coaching. Like, their players for the most part are fine, but if you have upperclassmen quarterbacks who are still careless with the ball, if you have major breakdowns in special teams, which showed last year, it was that they didn't have a kicker at all. This year, they go this kick return touchdown, just the latest. Like, the deficits with Nebraska are starting to feel more and more attributable to coaching than to the players they've got.
And to anybody wondering, God, how did this team get rolled by Lovie Smith's Illini? That's exactly why. All you have to do, you don't have to do anything spectacular to beat that team. You just have to not make enormous mistakes that cost your team points and give the other team points. And Nebraska is prone to doing that, much more so than perhaps any team in their division.
Yeah, and I have to say that notwithstanding the result of this game, Schiano still gets my vote for Coach of the Year, not that I have one. Because this is, again, I mean, you can look at Rutgers' schedule up and down, and the only game that was out of control on the scoreboard was Ohio State. And even that game, they fought the Buckeyes the whole game. So considering the turnaround they made from last season to this, I think Rutgers might be, I mean, is there an argument that Rutgers is the fan base that has the most optimism after this season, maybe excluding Ohio State? I really don't even know what kind of world their fans live in when you're talking about next year versus this year.
Well, here's the thing, like, at the, you know, after that, you know, we're going to talk about both of these games, but as Ohio State scores to take the lead for the first time in the Big Ten championship game, I got to imagine Ohio State fans are just going, God, thank you. Finally, my God, can we just get this? Like, took you long enough. Jesus Christ, what a dog shit performance. Come on. Now let's just get a stop and get out of here. This is just, whereas, you know, Illinois ties it up with Penn State with a really, you know, after giving up a really stupid touchdown in a meaningless game. And I'm just, woo! So that's the difference. I got more excited about meaningless touchdowns against Penn State than Ohio State fans probably got about scoring a touchdown to take the lead in a conference title game.
Yeah, and I'm just over here trying to keep track of if we're going to have like 50 scholarship players next year, we will, by the way, and we'll get into that maybe a little bit in a preview, because MSU's game was one of several that were canceled. We only have four games to talk about from the Big Ten this week. So this might be the time when we manage to not stumble our way to 45 minutes. I feel like we're going to get there anyway, because we always find some kind of tangent to go on. But yeah, to get back to our original point though,
Rutgers had 8 watchable games this year.
Yeah. If you were to rank Rutgers, or to rank fan bases by current satisfaction levels, it's probably like Indiana and Rutgers right at the top, like Ohio State disgruntled because there's still a question mark about whether they deserve to be in the playoff. Like, that's got to rankle them for whatever reason. Who cares? You're there. Who cares what anyone else thinks? Especially Dabo Swinney ranking them at 11. What a chump. I just, like, he's the one of the most successful guys in his profession. He's got millions and millions of dollars in the bank, all the fame and power you could want. He runs that school. And he still feels the need to be so petty about ridiculous crap like that. I kind of respect the hustle with that type of pettiness.
You know, if you're a Rutgers fan, if you're a fan of a program that's just been dragged through the mud and been just a meme for a while, again, coming from experience, what you want more than anything is just for the team to be watchable week to week. You want to be able, you don't want to be turning off the game in the third quarter being like, I knew it was going to be like this. I don't know why I even bothered. And Rutgers.
Third quarter, man. Half the time, they didn't make it to halftime before you.
Yep. 8 weeks out of 9, with the one exception being against Ohio State, who does this to everybody. They were in it until the end of the game. Their fans had every reason to watch it right to the end. They played a couple of overtime games. They were in one possession games. And they won 3 of them. So I don't know what more you could possibly ask for Rutgers for step one. You just want to be watchable. Well, I mean, honestly, Rutgers probably was the most watchable team in the Big Ten this year. Would you agree? Every Rutgers game was must-see TV.
Okay.
That's not to say that they were good, but it was fun and compelling and competitive.
So hold on. No, because I don't know if all those things necessarily follow. So
Penn State wasn't that close a game.
Well, right. But no, what I'm getting at more is that close games are not necessarily compelling games, right? Because if you were to look up and down their schedule, I would bet you Northwestern probably played in more closer games than Rutgers did. They had plenty of like 1 and 3 and 4 point games too. I would not call those games watchable. You know what I mean? Like, the fact that they were in a lot of tight games doesn't, because Rutgers is still playing kind of an unpleasant form of offense. It's certainly much better than it used to be, but I don't know if I would call that, like, there are still teams, and, you know, I know people are going to say that they're tired of hearing this, but I still find, for example, Purdue interesting to watch because they have a dynamic, fun-to-watch offense and these fascinating individual players like David Bell, Rondale Moore when he was healthy. I think that's a different kind of compelling than Rutgers is, where if you want to, they're a different kind of compelling, maybe that's a better way to put it, because it is, there's a different kind of satisfaction you get out of watching a team that clearly enjoys every minute of every game, that believes utterly in their coach. And if they don't quite have the talent to necessarily be all that good just yet, at least they're better. And they're certainly watchable in the sense that they're not just playing an atrocity against football every time they take the field. That's true. Yes. That what they are now putting on is watchable football, but at most watchable, I think that's a stretch. I mean, I'd much rather tune into Indiana, Purdue, that type of team.
Honestly, say if my team had the track record that Rutgers did, not that it was a whole lot better, but we had a bowl last year, right? So I'm talking, if it's 2018 for me and a brand new coach does what Greg Schiano did at Rutgers, I'm overjoyed. I'm, you know, hyped for next year.
Absolutely. And they should be. And I'm not trying to take that away from or disagree. I'm just saying that as a neutral outsider, in terms of, like, if there's a slate of 3 or 4 games, you know, pretend this is a normal year, pretend it's next year, and we've got a full slate of games again, please God, let that happen. And the choice is like, well, do I want to watch, say, Rutgers, Indiana, or do I want to watch, you know, one of these other conference games? Like, the fact that they're in a game isn't necessarily going to catch my eye.
Until the game you were planning on watching ends up going off the rails, and then you check the scores and you're like, hey, wait a second. Rutgers is like down 3 and this game is like 30-33 for some reason. And what the hell is going on in this game? I got to see this.
Yeah. So they're still more of an oddity than an attraction in the way that, here's a good example. If I'm looking, if it were a normal non-conference Saturday, for example, and I'm looking at other games I might be interested in, like Memphis is a team that always catches your eye, right? Or Appalachian State, like where there's a certain kind of like, they do something on the field that draws your eye. There's really nothing.
Tulane!
Yet. Right. So in that sense, I would disagree, but the overall theme here of, are they anything but overjoyed with Greg Schiano? No, of course they are. And if we're looking at the flip side of this and talking about where Nebraska is, I mean, sure, they steadied the ship a little bit and got a couple of wins down the stretch, but I don't know where Nebraska goes from here. I don't know what the what reasonable expectations for them would be next year. It still feels like they really haven't resolved their quarterback situation, because although they only played Adrian Martinez in this game, four turnovers, man. Like, that's, you can't have that going forward. You've got to figure out, and that's like the huge majority of their turnovers have been caused by their quarterbacks. That's, you know, Scott Frost was a quarterback. It's supposed to be this play calling guru, and he can't figure out how to stop his signal callers from turning the ball over. That's a huge problem. And it's a big enough micro level problem that it could derail the whole thing if he doesn't get it under control.
Well, Scott Frost now ties Lovie Smith's record for the past 3 years.
Good on him. It's
at 12-20.
Happy to celebrate it. So, speaking of Lovie Smith, we'll cover now the one game of the Rob Smith era at Illinois, a 35-point loss to Penn State, which, to be fair, looked like it was going to be a hilarious, entertaining shootout for, what, like the first quarter, not quite a quarter, and then Illinois basically ran out of mana, and you apparently forgot to put your healer in the party before this boss fight, so you're just taking piles of damage and didn't have any way to cover for it.
Well, what happened was we allowed a 75-yard touchdown on the first play from scrimmage, fitting tribute to Lovie Smith. But then the offense was fun because Rod Smith was intent on proving to everybody that this wasn't his fault. And specifically, he might as well have put out a statement that said, I was ordered to start Brandon Peters and play this weird hybrid offense instead of starting Isaiah Williams and do what I want to do with the offense.
Yeah.
That's basically what happened. And it
was pretty firmly conveyed as well.
And what was interesting was the defense was blitzing, had like one high safety and man coverage. And interesting to see that shit.
Not that it helped, but
yeah. Well, I mean, we led 21-14, and then get this, for the second time in 3 years, we gave up 42 straight to Penn State. We yeah. just do that sometimes. So kind of whatever. The wheels fell off, and my only regret from this one is that we couldn't give up another touchdown to Penn State to make it a 63 burger, which would have been a fitting end.
We would be remiss, and I think this is a good point to talk about it, not pointing out that, yes, Illinois did fire Lovie Smith, and they have hired former Big Ten West stalwart and division runner Brett Bielema, who apparently had, so after his time at Arkansas, he spent a year in Bill Belichick's, you know, film dungeon. And then he was, I think, like the outside linebackers coach for the Giants. So sort of an interesting career path that he's taken to get to Champaign from Madison, you know, via Fayetteville, Foxborough, and the Meadowlands. And then
well, I'll tell you, when I first knew this was what was going to happen was when I looked at the field of candidates, I saw there just wasn't a lot of competition because not a lot of schools firing their coaches this year. And I saw, man, there's like a lot of candidates that I would really like. In fact, there's really only one that I wouldn't like. And then I realized, oh, yeah, we are 100% hiring the one that I don't want.
Yeah. And so, look, it's completely fair to say that once he ventured out from under the house that Barry Alvarez built, things did not go well for Brett Bielema. But it's still the dynamic there was always interesting, right? Because plainly, nobody thought at the time that he was leaving for a better job. The assumption that I recall was, well, he's leaving because he wants to be able to do things his own way a little more. He doesn't like being, you know, I can imagine there being some argument at some point where Alvarez is like, look, as long as you're in my house, you'll obey my rules. And it's like, fine, I'm moving out then, bro. And then he quits and takes the Arkansas job like a petulant teenager or something, because I don't know how else that could have gone down, really.
Yeah, you know, famously easy to work with person Barry Alvarez.
Right.
You know, person who famously people don't really fucking hate him when they're forced to work with him for a long time.
Yeah, that never happened before. You've never had, for example, another coach quit in the middle of the season and go back to Oregon State just to get the hell away from Barry. Like that's never happened.
So I don't know. It's weird because at that point there's a situation where you had an asshole mentoring an asshole. and by all accounts, they're still both assholes.
You have not heard much about Bielema basically since he went back to the NFL and became, and well, not back to the NFL for the first time and became this anonymous assistant, but there hasn't been anything out there. Like normally when you see this kind of hire, like a guy coming back into a more prominent media stage like this, if he had sort of the rumored and half confirmed personality issues in the past, normally you'd see some like write-ups like, oh, he's, you know, a changed man and he's bound to turn over a new leaf. There hasn't been none of that.
So. Well, I saw a lot of write-ups about how Steve Sarkisian went to rehab and stuff. And even though that's the, from Arkansas message board, that seems to be how his time at Arkansas fell apart, was that he had put together some legitimately pretty good teams at Arkansas and things fell apart quickly when he apparently fell off the wagon. Coaches stopped respecting him because he started not showing up to meetings. He pissed off Sam Pittman, who left, and then he couldn't keep his staff together. And then the wheels just fell off and he gained like a shitload of weight and then just kind of got burned out. So this is a thing. I guess the reason that my reaction to this hire was so viscerally bad is because I think it's kind of fair for me to be worried about somebody coming to Champaign to be the head coach of Illini football and just being the worst version of themselves, because that's generally what's happened. But I don't want to overlook the fact that a motivated and sober Brett Bielema is probably a pretty competent Big Ten football coach. I can't in any way give him all the credit for the stuff that happened at Wisconsin. I certainly don't want to give him credit for that time that 2012 Wisconsin got to the Rose Bowl because Ohio State self-banned and Penn State got banned. That had nothing to do with him, or if that had anything to do with him, then he is an evil genius who we should absolutely give a lifetime contract to if he orchestrated that. But he proved in his press conference that he, more than any Illini coach I've seen, knows how to say what the people want to hear, knows how to do the song and dance, and that's not nothing. Because what is recruiting and networking but saying what everybody wants to hear, right? If he puts together a staff, which he's, and again, to give him credit for saying the right things, he said that he wants to have a staff together by the first week of the new year. Well, that's good, because that means, he said it himself, that he understands how important this recruiting cycle is, so he's got to get the staff together by then. It's an aggressive goal, but, those are his words. So I'm hoping that, that's going to tell us all we need to know, because if he assembles a stud staff of X's and O's guys and, recruiters with a lot of juice, especially guys with ties to the areas Illinois likes to recruit, well, then I'll be a lot less worried about about Brett becoming the worst version of himself in short order.
Well, and you mentioned there's a couple important things there. So staff is going to be critical, because how many coaching regimes have we seen in the Big Ten that end up failing because within the first couple of years, the coach has to fire a coordinator because he just completely got the hire wrong.
Our last coach.
Yeah. That is not something that many coaching regimes get over. And from a recruiting standpoint, as things stand now, Illinois is dead last in the conference. They are barely within the top 80 nationally. And that's after signing the 88th ranked class last year. Now, he's going to have to figure out very quickly, like, who is staying, who is going. I think I remember seeing Josh Amaterbebe is off to the NFL, but plenty of other seniors who could take another crack at it if Bielema wants them back. And, the number of guys who come back, I think, like, it's still not clear to me with this blanket waiver of eligibility, how scholarship numbers are going to work. Like, if you end up getting a bunch of seniors who come back, does that mean you have to take like a 5-man freshman class? It doesn't seem to be the case. I haven't seen anyone whittling down their scholarship numbers, but that kind of thing has never been explained. The NCAA hasn't bothered to explain any of that. So you've got a recruiting class with nobody ranked higher. I mean, I'm looking at the 24/7 rankings right now. Illinois has one guy for the 2021 class inside of the top 500 nationally.
Brody Weiss-Carver.
Yeah, it's number 475. So you combine this class with last year's class, and the fact that with a new coach, you always have some roster transition. He's not going to have the luxury of this class being a complete black hole. Like, he's got to get some useful players here.
Well, the other thing that he has, The other thing that he has to do is a thing that I'm really sick of seeing our coaches not do. He's going to need to find a way to win some games with the players that he inherits. Because it's not impossible. We didn't leave him with nothing, nor was Lovie Smith left with nothing. Everybody said that Jeff Brohm was left with nothing. And whether Jeff Brohm is any good now doesn't matter. He took those players and he won more games than anybody thought possible with them in year one. You can do it. You just have to actually try. And you have to have strategies to do it. So I'm hoping that, for instance, for a defensive coordinator, that who he picks, he values, he hinted at this too, because he said they were going to run a 3-4 and then he backed away from that, basically saying, you know, it's a lot more important to me that one, they be able to coach guys fundamentally and technique and stuff, than what philosophy they're running. But I'm hoping that that means that he values their ability to scheme for their talent and scheme for their matchups versus what specific thing they want to run. Because we just had a guy whose whole thing was, I'm running what I'm running until it's perfect. And that's all I'm going to do, because when I get it perfect, we'll dominate. And guess what? That's what Don Brown did at Michigan. That's what Rob Smith did at Minnesota and Rutgers. And those are not working. Don Brown just got canned.
No, that approach very rarely works unless you have perfect
overwhelming talent.
Yeah, which doesn't happen anywhere in this conference except Ohio State with consistency. So they can.
And if you're Ohio State, what's it matter how you scheme defensively?
No, they could run the flex bone. They could run air raid. It wouldn't make a difference. They're going to be fine because they have the best talent. So that's obviously important. We'll see how this goes. I mean, it seems to me, I feel like most of the Illinois sources I've seen are kind of pessimistic, but most of the outside sources are more neutral. Like, I haven't seen anybody really predicting, oh, this is going to be a huge success. They'll win a couple conference titles. Like, I don't see anybody predicting that, but the outside sources are like, well, that could work. And I think that's kind of where I am, where, no, like the general trajectory here, Illinois' recent history with football hires, the place where Bielema was when they found him, and how it went with his last major college football job. Because really, I mean, if you were to compare where Arkansas was in the SEC West when he got there to where Illinois is relative to the Big Ten West now, it's not a terrible comparison. So if you're hoping that he's able to simulate that initial burst of energy he had where he did have a couple of good years at Arkansas, and that he's then able to kind of hold things together a little bit longer.
So here we go. Here's some scenarios. Here's some scenarios that I think are all possible, right? So a median scenario would be one where, you know, Brett Bielema does feel a little embarrassed about the way things went at Arkansas and does, I mean, I don't know. I lost a job once and I was, you know, I was really motivated when I got to my next one to be like, you know, hey, I'm going to prove those assholes wrong that like I belong here. I don't feel like I have anything to prove to those assholes because screw them, right? But I'm going to anyway, even though they'll never see me. So anyway, you know, Bielema comes in with that kind of attitude, you know, because the athletic director made it a priority to him, recruit, you know, establishes relationships with Illinois high school coaches, goes to all the clinics and stuff that Lovie couldn't be bothered to, brings in a bunch of his old buddies, you know, because he's got buddies everywhere from, which is one of the benefits of hiring a guy that's been around high level Power Five football for so long, is he's got a lot of guys, you know, guys that have been good coordinators but failed as head coaches, longtime position guys. He puts together a staff of those type of people, and Illinois puts together some top 50 recruiting classes and ends up with a 5-7 floor in a couple of years. Bielema leaves when they get a bowl game and he gets offered more money because everybody suddenly sees the upside. There's a median scenario that's possible. There's also a scenario where Bielema simply saw how long of a leash Lovie Smith got and thought, well, I'm back in Illinois. I'm in the Big Ten and they got to respect the recruiting acumen I had at Wisconsin. So this is going to be easy. I can do this in my sleep. And so I'm going to, and he just tries to cash a check and get a big fat buyout. And we don't see the effort that we thought we'd see. And, you know, it kind of ends up being all on the staff who then bail after a couple of years of this. And we're right back where we were in 4 years. Then there's a scenario where all the shit that he said in the press conference was true. We're hiring him at his lowest point. This is the end of act two in the hero's journey. and he realizes that he had to come home to where it all began. Even though he, as a recruit from Illinois, chose to go out of state to Iowa, he now suddenly believes that it's his duty to make the opposite happen for everybody, and that, in fact, the biggest motivator for him is now spite of Barry Alvarez, which is a very powerful force. And he's cleaned up his act. He's cleaned up his act. Having a couple of kids at home has made him really reflect on the kind of person he is and who he wants to be. Maybe he's not even a Roethlisberger tier asshole to everybody anymore. And you know, and this is the next chapter where he's just an exemplary human being, and he just does all the things right and really unlocks the full potential of what he could be. And Illinois runs the Big Ten West in 5 years. So I don't think that one's going to happen, but I'm certainly hoping that that's as likely as the cash a paycheck and get that buyout after 3 years scenario. I think it's probably a lot closer to the first scenario I outlined, but you can see the variance there. There may be a lot of upside, but hopefully the idea that Whitman had, our athletic director, is that the floor is probably higher for this guy than, for instance, Marcus Freeman, who we interviewed, the defensive coordinator for Cincinnati. That's a guy I think is going to be a star in the future, but we needed somebody that had head coaching experience because nobody in this program has any idea what it's like to be around a winning football program, right? So we couldn't hire an up-and-coming coordinator that hasn't done the job before. Personally, though, I would have been overjoyed with Dave Clawson, and I think he could have been had for the money we got Brett Bielema. I would have liked Lance Leipold. I thought that Jeff Monken would have been interesting. Whatever. We're doing this now. So I guess let's just hope for the best. We will see what happens when he puts together a staff.
Did you take a breath at any point in that?
Not very many.
Yeah, I guess I don't really have any thing further to say other than that you mentioned the guy. Leipold would have been the first guy I would have called if I was in Illinois' position, but what do I know? So the flip side of this,
there was a really funny thing. There was a rumor that was spread on a forum or something like that. Illinois had, like, for some reason, Illinois fans and, like, you know, some, like, our 24/7 people really strongly believed the night before the MAC championship that Leipold was 95% the guy and that it was going to be announced after the title game. So that means that you had, like, the whole Illini internet watching the MAC title game as they just melted down. And then we were all like, oh, okay, now I believe that he's interviewed for the Illinois
job.
Yeah,
now he's definitely a guy after we see this performance. Yeah.
So anyway, moving on.
Well, before we do, just a quick note on Penn State, the other half of this game. So,
oh, yeah, that happened.
Right. Well, it's worth noting that after the 0-5 start, Penn State rallied a little bit. And sure, the schedule got quite a bit easier. Michigan State and Illinois down the stretch, Rutgers as well. But it was fair saying because we were wondering through the midst of the season, like, man, what happens if Penn State goes 0-8 or 1-7 here? Like, does that change James Franklin's job situation? He, you know, this move didn't end up happening, but there was chatter about James Franklin being a possible candidate for the Texas job. And I'm like, really, in an 0-5 season, he's the guy that they feel like throwing the money, you know, aiming the money cannon at. So it seems like things there have kind of stabilized. They've sorted out their quarterback situation here where they're going to be, it feels a little bit like the situation they had with McSorley and Stevens, but with a slightly bigger role for Will Levis. We'll see if that holds next year. It feels like they're going to be hit pretty hard by the NFL draft. I don't think we've seen a whole lot of declarations yet. There was Micah Parsons before the season, Pat Freiermuth's already declared, but I believe Jahan Dotson would be draft eligible, and it's hard to believe after this breakout year that he wouldn't go. Shaka Toney and Jason Owe are going to be guys as well that could consider going. But again, you've also got the situation where all your seniors might return next year. So Penn State's going to be an interesting roster to watch. They could have a fair amount of turnover here, but they're the one non-Ohio State team that's recruited well enough to survive that kind of thing. So
maybe their players are all watching and waiting and seeing what Ohio State players declare for the draft after they're done with this season. I mean, like, all right, are we going to have a chance? If we all band together, can we get them this next year if enough of their players leave?
I misunderstood you. So you're saying if enough Ohio State players go, that Penn State might be like, all right, now's our chance. Let's everyone come back and we'll take a swing.
Come on. All right. Enough of them are gone. Quick. The mods are asleep. let's steal the Big Ten title.
No, I don't think that many individual players who have viable NFL choices in front of them are going to look at it that way. It would be a very amusing thing, but I'll put it, it would only be funny if they say outright that's what they're doing. If like, if five of them come out and they're like, no, we're coming back because Ohio State's defenses are down and this is our one chance to blow them up before they complete construction of the ballot. Like, you know, basically yes. to attack the Death Star before they finish building it. Because, you know, with the way Ohio State's recruiting right now, there's not going to be much of a gap in the shields there, man. So even if that's the case, I wouldn't necessarily like Penn State's chances next year. But, no, somehow I don't think that's going to be how players with an NFL future are going to view it. It would be hilarious and entertaining, so I'm rooting for it, and it won't happen. Right. Now, speaking of entertaining, let's go to the opposite of that and talk about basically the game that was the cause for all the last-second schedule shuffling, because this game just had to happen. We had to see this. Wisconsin 20, Minnesota 17 in overtime.
What a stupid game.
Yes, but also perhaps the most precisely evenly matched game of the year. And the only difference between these two teams in this game was that Minnesota's kicking situation is still unreliable. Because other than that, I looked at this game, and from a statistical standpoint, I watched a pretty good portion of it. And I found myself thinking during the game, man, these two teams are very evenly matched this year as they're currently constructed. That's not to say that if things had gone normally, that it would have been the same. I think it would have been considerably different. But
How about this? Do you have the team stats up?
Not right now, but I've got a number of them listed.
If you get up the team stats, I'll read Minnesota's and you read Wisconsin's.
Hold on. I got to go to last week now. I didn't go into that level of depth when I was considering this, but...
But I'm looking at it, and it's remarkable.
Right, that's why I put a bunch
all the way down.
Hold on. All right, box score, go ahead.
All right, Minnesota, first downs, 18.
Wisconsin, first downs, 18.
Third down efficiency, 4 for 12.
Hang on, I don't have that just yet. I don't think I have a column for that.
4 for 12. Total yards, 326. 322. Passing, 14 for 26, 16 for 25. Rushing attempts, 36, 36. Turnovers, 1, 1. Possession, 29, 32, 30, 28.
30 seconds of exactly even possession. Yeah, like, it doesn't happen.
It's yeah, just, no, this really was as evenly matched a game as I think I've ever seen from a statistic. The total yards difference was 4.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's up and down, as similar as it possibly could have been. It's absolutely the meme of the two Spider-Men pointing at each other, but they're both holding a hams like this. You know? The entire difference here was that Minnesota just does not have a reliable kicker, and Wisconsin does, and that was the whole difference in the game. I guess if you're thinking about this from the macro perspective of the fan bases, if you're Wisconsin, you look at this season, which was just shattered into 100 pieces by COVID and also losing to Northwestern, which you shouldn't have done. And maybe you kind of shrug and you figure, look, we got a pretty good amount of pieces coming back next year. We've got a system running here. There's no reason to think this is going to be a long-term disruption. Whereas if you're Minnesota, you're disappointed to lose the Axe back-to-back years, sure. But I think you look at the dead even balance in the box score here, and you think back to where this series was before Fleck got to Minneapolis. And I think that you feel pretty confident in this amount of time that you're now dead even with Wisconsin. And sure, if you were being totally honest with yourself, you would admit this is an unusual year and Wisconsin's probably going to be better most of the time than they were this season. But you can still say to yourself, look, we've decisively closed the gaps. If we had all of our full complement of players available, if we could get our kicking game sorted out, we'd probably win this game. So there's reason for both teams to come out of this feeling optimistic, but Wisconsin takes the axe for what is that like? 19 times out of 20 or something.
Yeah. So I got a question. Minnesota got to be feeling, you know, pretty decent to finish with the record that they did, given all of the players they were missing and everything. And they were able to cobble together some stuff. And then Penn State, they started 0-5 and they won their last four. So my question is, who has more, we won the NIT, so now we're going to make a big run next year energy?
Oh, Penn State for sure.
Yeah.
Only because they're the ones who, realistically, I mean, again, remember, even in the second week of this year after losing the opening week, they were still in a competitive game with Ohio State. And, you know, in the later stages, that game had a little bit of a boat race feel to it. But they were still given by far the best chance to beat the Buckeyes this year. They still have the best recruiting base outside of Columbus. So there's I guess I should ask for a clarification. Do you mean who should be feeling the best or who is? Because it wouldn't surprise me if Minnesota fans are looking at an undeserved win over Purdue, kind of a fluky win. There was who was the game they played after that that they managed to slip through as well? Was it Nebraska?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're kind of ignoring that a couple of these notches in the win column probably should have gone the other way. And buying into this culture of, no, everything is great all the time. This is exactly according to plan, and we deserved every ounce of this. Like, that vibe is out there as well. So if the answer is who should be feeling, you know, that they can take on the King next year, it should be Penn State. Who is feeling that? I don't know. Maybe Minnesota does still delude themselves into that, and they're kind of whistling past the graveyard on some of the issues that were exposed this year, particularly on defense, because they're still going to have a crazy young back seven last year. And they didn't really show the improvement on that side of the ball that I would have thought over the course of the season. Had better scoring totals, sure, but also played some weaker offenses down the stretch.
So we've been dancing around it, but we need to give everybody a round of applause. I guess ourselves included, because we're part of the Big Ten media sphere. Congratulations. We did it, everybody. We got Ohio State into the playoff. Congratulations. That's a wrap. We'll see you here to do it again next year.
Can't wait to see them go out and probably lose by 10 to Clemson. That's probably the, what'd you say, like between a couple standard deviations of the expected outcome would be them losing between 7 and 14 points to Clemson. That feels about right.
Roughly.
That's going to be after a matchup in which, man, despite having a massive talent advantage in just about every place on the field, a truly horrendous game by both Ryan Day and Justin Fields resulted in a game that for three quarters looked like Ohio State was really, really trying to blow this. Because I don't know that I've seen a conference game like this recently where one unit so dominated the game the way Ohio State's offensive line did in this game. And yet they were so reluctant to run the ball. And this was with, you know, they're missing Chris Olave. And you could tell that those two have been, him and Garrett Wilson have been the main engines of this passing game all year, because I think it's maybe fair to say that Justin Fields doesn't necessarily trust anybody else, because with Olave gone, Wilson was really the only threat they had out there. And so Northwestern doubled him a pretty good amount of the game. And Ohio State's passing game didn't seem to have an answer for that. They had I think the box scores ended up looking a little bit more attractive than they really were. But Fields' passing line was not good for most of the day. It's not like he was under constant pressure. I mean, the dominance I'm talking about from that front line was not just in the run game. He would drop back, and there's not the slightest hint of the pocket collapsing. Like, his guys are in front of him just like, no, we got this, bro. Like, they're holding him back like a line of riot policemen at a Rusted Root concert or something. Like, there's no need for that kind of force against Northwestern's front. They're not that effective rushing the passer. Fields has all kinds of time, and he's still misfiring, making bad interceptions. And Ryan Day keeps telling him to throw the ball, even though Trey Sermon ends up breaking the single game rushing record for Ohio State. And he got probably, what, 2/3 of it after halftime? Like, it was just bizarre to me that they wouldn't just hand the ball to this guy 30 times and say, win the game. You can do it, because he could have.
You know what this smells like to me? And I'm getting to a point with Ohio State where I don't even know how much I'm joking. And this is where, like, if you've played a lot of dynasty mode in NCAA football, sometimes you find yourself in a situation where, like, yeah, I'm obviously going to win this last game of the season. The question is, my quarterback is the only guy that I've got in the Heisman top five. I got to get him the stats to put him over the top here. Yes, they have a better secondary than their run defense, but, like, I got like it doesn't do me any good if I just win the game because my bat goes off for 300 yards. I want that Heisman.
Well, that would be strange to me, because I don't think anyone I haven't seen Fields really discussed as a serious candidate for that anymore, because it sounds to me like Heisman voters are still going to go based off of counting stats. And because he's only played six games, his are nowhere near, you know, the Mac Jones and Kyle Trasks of the world. Like, he's not going to. It would be a surprise if he got an invite, even, to be honest.
Well, by Heisman, in other words, by Heisman voter logic, Nathan Shieldhouse is better than Justin Fields because he threw for more yards.
Yeah. So anyway, this, you know, this ends up being an outcome where even though they won, the fact that they struggled against lowly Northwestern, who's, you know, a one-loss team ranked in the mid-teens, still ended up causing much consternation in the ESPN, SECPN bubble sphere about whether Ohio State deserves to go. Much ado about nothing, because they do end up going. And we'll get into the previews of that, of the playoff and the rest of the bowl games in the Big Ten slate in the preview section, which is going to be very short because, again, there's only going to be a handful of Big Ten teams in bowl games this year. We'll take a look at one other thing, though, that I found interesting. If there's anything else around the country from last week that caught your eye, we can do that. We can also talk about any of the first couple days worth of bowl games, but I haven't seen anything compelling so far. And that was that our sister conference in the Pac-12, really the conference most similar in tradition and mindset to the Big Ten. Of course, we'll all recall that what their championship would have been under normal rules would have been Washington versus USC. However, because of a COVID issue at Washington, they were not able to play. And so the conference, instead of, you know, postponing or finding some alternate arrangement, just said, well, we'll just have Oregon go instead. This, by the way, was an Oregon team that was 2-3 at the time.
Yeah, with a loss to Cal.
Yeah. But they were second place in the Pac-12 North. And so they go to the conference title game against an otherwise undefeated USC, which is, despite being undefeated USC, still only ranked 13 because they played a horrendously weak Pac-12 South schedule, because the Pac-12 South was terrible this year. And then, of course, the inevitable happens and Oregon wins the game. They win the Pac-12 title at 3-3, which means they're entitled to the conference's New Year's Six bid.
And USC gets nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
Hold on. They don't get nothing. What they get? Oh, man, I knew this and now I've forgotten. Let me look it up. What did they get? Actually, they do get nothing. It doesn't look like they took a bowl bid.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the bowl projection. Colorado is playing Texas. And then in what's probably going to be the worst New Year's Six game since Michigan and Virginia Tech in that awful Sugar Bowl, we have Oregon. Oh, I'm sorry. Oregon must have been 3-2, not 2-3. I was wondering how that was even possible that they were in the title game, but I just remembered that wrong. So no, Oregon was 3-2. They're now 4-2. And I guess just because we can't have a New Year's Six game with an unranked team, they got bumped up to number 25. They're going to play Iowa State in the Fiesta Bowl. And what is going to, like I said, the worst New Year's Six game right there with that Sugar Bowl between Michigan and Virginia Tech.
Oh boy. It's just bringing me back to when we dropped, to when the Fighting Illini dropped UCLA to 6-8 the one year.
And the Kraft Fight Hunger Bowl. Does that bowl still exist?
It does. In fact, it's the Red Box Bowl now.
That explains everything.
Your source for Big Ten Talk, it's Off Tackle Empire.